Hi and welcome. This is Dave. How are you?
Good.
Great. Who is this?
This is Terry Holmes.
Terry, welcome. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. How are
you? I'm doing
good.
Great. Thanks.
Good.
We have a new member who will introduce herself when we all get assembled. How's everything been going for you?
Going good. I have been participating, but quite frankly, I'm doing it at work. It is my business, but I also put myself on mute because the other phone lines ring and so forth.
I see.
So although I am participating, you may not know it.
Yeah, well, is that working okay for you?
It is. It is.
Okay, great.
And when I have things to add or discuss, I certainly will do that.
Super. Super. What's your take on the training so far? Is it what you expected, and any thoughts or suggestions?
Actually, it is what I expected. I had done your new health story.
Uh-huh, the new life story.
The wellness story series, and I really enjoyed that. I'm really liking this. I'm still in the space of being kind of stuck. In terms of wanting to, you know, create a coaching business outside of my the studio,
uh-huh.
And I really vacillate between, is that something I want to do, or do I want to try to figure out a way to do it within teaching dancing.
Uh-huh.
And I'm just not quite sure how to mesh those two. Although I do it all the time, I don't call it that.
I see.
And people come to, you know, they come to us for something other than dance lessons, but they don't know that. So I don't want to start, you know, I don't want to tell them.
You don't want to let them in on it.
Yeah.
Do you have a space where you can treat it like an office that has privacy and no interruptions, where you could do coaching calls there if you chose?
You know, I do. I have, right now we're in the midst of a lot of upheaval. We're going to be moving within the next couple of months.
Oh, yeah.
And there's just a lot going on. So I'm really taking it in. I'm getting a lot out of it. I'm doing the work myself. And perhaps it is just a timing thing. I don't know.
Uh-huh. Well, you'll really know the difference between dosing and timing and titrating versus procrastination.
Mm-hmm.
And you can always fail.
Yep.
And when it's time, you know, it'll be exciting for you. Is your goal to have parallel practices, parallel businesses?
Actually, it is. I would like to. One of the reasons, and I think part of what's getting me stuck is the part of the reason I've had two total knee replacements, and I teach dancing for a living.
Oh, wow.
And there is a shelf life. I mean, there's going to come a point where physically it's just too difficult for me to do. So I'm trying to look at, okay, what direction do I want to take my next thing, my next life? So I think that's part of it, is just, you know, sorting all of that out.
Walking over to my Eames chair is incredibly easy on my knees every day. I even take them out to exercise and they don't protest. So, yeah, it's interesting to look down the pike and around the corner and see what you want to do, because one of the great things about coaching is you can do it anywhere, and your clients can too if you do it by telephone, if you choose to do it that way. I mean, you saw my note. I'm going to be in a very different location for the next month, and I'm still going to be doing everything I do. So it's really portable and flexible in many ways.
And I think there's a part of me that is kind of mourning, you know, that – there's a sense of loss there for me,
sure.
And I think there's a part of me that's kind of mourning that a little bit. So. I
understand that, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, every step ahead means relinquishing a past position. So
absolutely.
I think the important thing is to really be with that whole transition process.
Yep.
Yeah, excellent. Well, thanks for the progress note. Who else is here and ready to check in?
I'm here. This
Hello.
Is Jen.
Oh. Jen, welcome. Thank you for your roadmap. I want to get to that before we move into the material, just after we do, reporting in and we have a new participant to introduce herself. Is Mary Beth here? Okay. I think my material got to her. Jen, what's going on for you?
Well, I'm good. That exercise was really exciting, so I'm super eager to get into it.
Okay. All right. Excellent.
And but other than that, I'm good, Dave. Thank you.
Okay. Super. Who else wants to?
Oh, and
in?
I also enjoyed your call today. I
oh,
want
good.
To say that.
Thank you. I'm glad
that
you were able to attend.
Fantastic. Yeah. Thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah. There are so many incredible people. I love to hear the success stories and the you know the best practices because people
mm-hmm.
are really willing to share a lot of neat stuff. So that's I hope enhancing for everybody. It's great. Really fun for me to do.
Good stuff.
Who else wants to check in?
Hi, Dave. This is Lalia. I'm getting some really strange buzzing from when you are talking.
When I talk?
I don't know if other people are experiencing that, but it's only when you're talking. When the other people on the call are talking, it's fine.
Anybody else hear that?
I do, but it's not bad.
Okay. I hear kind of a background buzz, too. I don't know. We
yeah.
have a farm, but I may have to check my line. It could be me instead of the bridge line, so I'll check on that.
Well, it's only when you're talking that.
Okay.
That.
Okay.
It goes in and out being kind of loud. So,
okay.
But anyway.
All right. All right, thanks.
Anyway,
I'm
Lalia.
Anything for you, Lalia?
No, I really, you know, I wanted to thank Jennifer, is it, who did the
mm-hmm.
the money, the story pages?
Yes, the roadmap,
The roadmap, yeah, that it's just, it's great to see an example of that, and it's you know, it's courageous for somebody to put themselves out there, so I want to thank you, Jen, for that.
Thank you, you're welcome, pleasure.
Yeah.
We are at week 6 now, and I would like to get down a volunteer for each of the remaining weeks so that we can be sure that everyone is able to present. Now, next week, you saw my note, we won't meet next week. What about the week after that, the week of the 18th? Who would volunteer to do that and distribute? You now have all the emails. You can directly distribute it to everyone. Who would volunteer to do a roadmap for the 18th?
Dave?
Yes.
Hi, I'm Lalia. I'll do one.
Okay. Thank you very much. All right, excellent.
When do you like that by, in terms of
just get it to us so that we'll have a couple
like maybe,
of days to review it before
okay,
before the class. Yeah, super.
Okay, sounds good.
Okay, what about let's see, the 25th is a Monday before Thanksgiving on Thursday. I think we'll meet unless somebody has an objection. Who would agree to do the 25th?
This is Terry Holmes. I'll do that.
Okay, super. Thank you. Excellent. And the next, December 2nd, who? I think we have some people who had schedule glitches. I will assign the remainder of the times then. And just ask people to trade if they have some major problem. But I'll assign that and I'll get it around to everybody. Okay? Any other things you'd like to talk about before we do Jennifer's roadmap or anybody else who wants to check in? Okay, let me check one more time. Has Mary Beth arrived? Okay. Jen, would you do your roadmap? Jennifer, you ready to do your roadmap? Are we having connection problems?
Dave, can you hear me?
Oh, yes, I can. Great.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, yes, thank you. I was saying, what do you mean by do?
Well, would you just review it for us and walk us through it and just
sure.
kind of present it to us? And then if there are questions or reflections that you have on it or interactions that we have, we'll come in at the end.
Okay. Yeah, this was a good learning opportunity for me because, I mean, in your process, not only just in my own world, but in my process of creating a roadmap for someone, I will have some questions particularly for you, Dave, so I hope that's okay. I do
Absolutely.
That along the way. Okay. So this I considered doing for a client of mine, which I mentioned last class, but then I was like, no, screw it. I'm going to do it for me because I need it just as much as my client. So this is me, and it's a story that I, a roadmap about a relationship, but it's the relationship that I have with my body or / body image, which has been something for me that's been, probably the toughest relationship in my whole adolescent and adult life. So recognizing authorship, you are writing your body story image from assumptions to every choice about feeling good, looking good, and loving your body. So I kind of nicked that from the sample you gave us, Dave, and I filled in the blanks. But is that a subtitle for recognize authorship, or is that something the previous author wrote?
That's yours now, because you've made it yours and you've focused on what you want to, what storyline you want to work on. So
okay.
That sounds very authentic for you.
Yeah. Okay, and so by recognizing authorship, I understand that I am aware now that I am the author of my body image story, although previously I would have listened to the tape that was programmed in my mind by people like my grandparents and classmates, coaches, bosses, and boyfriends. And I realized that for my entire life, I have been giving authorship to others. And I'm ready to write my own story about it. So that was a good eye-opening. I think that was pretty clear. Like, we have to first take ownership of it. And
powerful insight.
Yeah, it's pretty powerful. And that we haven't written the story that we've been living, you know? We've been living someone else's bullshit story, which is kind of a good eye-opener. And a good thing to write down, you know. I mean, to say it, to write it down or to say it out loud is way different than just sort of acknowledging it, you know, in a coaching session or something. So that was good. Should I continue, Dave?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a powerful way to say it. I haven't heard it said exactly so succinctly and so clearly. I haven't written the story I've been living. That's really
mm-hmm.
publishable, by the
mm-hmm,
way. That's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So owning your story, accountability is a prerequisite to change. This one, now I can own my own body image story, even though it's super difficult to believe that their story is not the story I believe anymore. It's also a bit sad to acknowledge that I've been living all these years with the negative tape running in my mind and beating up my sweet spirit. However, I will own my story as the real one and allow myself time to be with it. So that last part was important because it's not like, oh, I'm doing this exercise, now I own my story, and it's the real one. You know, it's kind of like, okay, so this is my story.
Yeah, it really feels powerful and authentic. Congratulations
yeah,
on the work you've done. This is huge.
Thank you. Should I continue?
Absolutely.
Okay. So assess plots and storylines. This one was pretty easy, yeah. Recognize the behaviors, hidden messages, and elusive language of mind and emotion. And this was so easy because I've looked at this for so long. It's easy for me to say where the story starts in second grade with my very Italian off the boat, East Coast, tell it like it is grandfather telling me that I had a fat ass. Good lovin'. I started dieting at age 11 when in grade school the mean girls and boys teased me about my weight and led me to believe that I was overweight and unacceptable. For the next 30 years, I would spend countless hours and tears fretting about my body and how unacceptable it was. Let's put it this way, there has not been one day, not one, where I did not focus on the unhappiness that my body brought. As a result of this focus, and of course in hindsight, I realize that I attracted friends, enemies, boyfriends, and bosses who found pleasure in reminding me that I was unacceptable in body shape. That, I do truly believe that by living someone else's story, I attracted someone else's comments and, just horrible attention that I wish I had never had attracted. But I think I attracted it, you know. It's as if because I thought it was true, I attracted just the right people to keep that story alive, you know, to affirm it. Because I was embarrassed by my body, I never got in a swimsuit in public. I missed dozens of beach outings. I don't wear dresses, shorts, or bright colors. I never joined sports teams. And worst of all, I learned not to get too close to people for fear that they might judge me. There was definitely a huge protective wall up for years. When I look in the mirror at my body, I'm usually critical and frustrated. What I need, and this was a good exercise, is to look at that list that came in the book, is acceptance, safety, and security. And I took a lot of time to choose those three. I thought that was a really brilliant exercise, very helpful for me.
I'm really impressed with your openness and psychological mindedness and flexibility to be able to talk about it, to look at yourself like this. This is very impressive work, and thank you for sharing it. It really enriches our experience to share.
Thank you. Yeah, one of the things that I'm coming to terms with is nothing that we live through is in vain, you know, Dave, and everything that we do, that I do anyway, I feel like is in a way to help someone else, and the best way I can help them is by stop, like, putting on the smiley face, you know, and to just, like, be very vulnerable.
Yeah.
And vulnerability, I mean, we know it's kind of a hot topic these days, and by golly, it should be, because it really goes a long way for growth, too. So, okay, decide what to change. Make informed choices about what story components to keep, let go of, change, and enhance. So this one and the next one, map changes, I felt maybe there was a bit of overlap, so I would like to help get your help to figure out. So decide what to change. I will no longer look externally for validation about my body image because I've been doing that forever. I will stop speaking negatively about my body. Instead, I will speak lovingly about and to my body. It deserves the love it has been deprived of all these years. I won't diet anymore. I will be unattached to others' opinions about me. Wow, that's easier said than done, isn't it? So
it's a process.
Yeah.
And there is some overlap and blending of these two, but it's really a decision, and then the mapping is the specific plan that you're going to
have. Okay. So it's a decision and then a plan. That's helpful. So, right, because you have to sort of be clear about what you want to do before you decide what you're going to do.
Exactly.
Okay. So then, let me see, if I decide that, then I'll add there, I will look in the mirror, and I did it this morning, and say, you are beautiful, and I love you unconditionally. So that'll be a mapped goal. I will practice acceptance of myself in other areas, and let this be a guide for accepting my body. Oh yeah, I thought this was rather good. Sometimes it's hard to just jump right to the thing that you've been, you know, rejecting your whole life. So I thought, oh, well, I'll just accept my nose or my, you know, I don't know, my laugh or something else that, is easier to accept, you know? And
no,
then
that makes sense to do it in a stepwise process instead
yeah.
of the whole deal.
And then just take cues from that. And then I'll also mark the times I feel safe and secure so as to become familiar with these feelings, because I don't feel safe and secure often around my body. So I will just recognize those few times that I do, like, you know, with my husband and sometimes in certain clothes or around certain friends. I'll mark those feelings of when I feel safe. And, you know, like also what I was doing, like did I exercise that day or was I thoughtful and intentional about my eating? Was I, you know, premenstruating? Was I, you know, these sort of things. Like I'm just going to mark those times so I can recognize them more. Okay, so decision and then plan. And then author new experiences. Create the new body image story you desire. Okay, so this is sort of speaking in the present and what my new story is, right?
Yes, I like the way you expanded each step to be specific for what you wanted and then elaborated about it. That really puts it into the context.
Oh, good, good, good. Yeah, it's helpful for me too. So the body image story I desire is, I'm a beautiful woman with a beautiful body. I accept my body exactly as it is and know that I am allowed to do so. I am allowed to do so. I go about the world with confidence in my appearance, and I wear clothing that is bright and fun, which is hilarious because I'm all in black today. I care for my body through healthy eating and exercise. My body is my gift, and I respect it and give it the love and admiration it deserves. I can be free of thoughts that bring me down and allow positive thoughts to take their place. I am allowed to be happy with my body. Those I feel very challenging to say, the part where it's, I am allowed to accept my body and I am allowed to be happy with my body. Those two sentences were the most difficult to say and probably to write, that I paid attention to that.
As you feel an increasing ownership, I think you can move to the active term instead of the passive term, because this is a process and you've done huge, just immense work. I allow myself, I am allowing myself, present tense and an active verb.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, I am allowing myself.
That's here and now, this moment. And that's a process, and it's a process to get to. To get to this place is immense.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I guess the step after that is, I am happy with my body, and I accept my body. I accept my body. That's the third. That would probably be the third unfolding. So I am allowed to. That's passive. I am allowing. That's active. And then sort of affirmative is, I am happy. Yeah.
Yeah, and remember the affirmations that are active and present tense, and the affirmations revise the software, just as the visualization rewires the brain. So you're actively working at revision of your own software and the software of your body image and belief system at the same time. And that's why I think it's huge.
Yeah, it's really, really powerful. This exercise has been with me since I did it, and more so than I had expected it to be, so I'm really glad I gave it to myself as a gift. So, to program new experience and identity, incorporate and sustain the changes by a corresponding internal growth. This one I'd really like your feedback on, because I pulled from the other, which I thought was a good model, right, that you gave us, and it talked mostly about identity. And then when I read in the book, right, it's about, like, what you identify with internally, right? So my identity will be that of someone who has pride in their physical appearance. I am free from other people's beliefs, opinions, or stories. I am the only author of my story. My identity is defined by me and only me. I will experience feeling accepted by myself and not look outward for the acceptance of others. I love myself, all of me. I retire the words that don't serve me and adopt only those that support me in owning my story. I will not repeat the old tapes. When I hear them, I will acknowledge them as old and belonging to someone else. I will then repeat my story and feel ownership for it. This was interesting. I identify with control. As I typed that, I was like, what does that even mean? But I think that was very a pretty good insight into me and what this is all about. And, you know, Dave, because you've worked with people on body image for a long time, and that's a control thing, right? I am in control of how I feel about my body. So instead of controlling, like, through food or through misery or berating, I feel like I'm changing that story and I'm in control of my feelings. Right? Because before, everyone else was in control of my feelings based on their crappy shit that they were telling me.
Exactly.
And now...
And the antithesis of control is mastery. So it sounds like you're experiencing a mastery and not having to control something externally, but really experiencing that sense of effectiveness and mastery, which is a very different experience.
Oh, I like that. I like that a lot. Yeah, mastery sounds a lot less like you have like a hard grip on it, It's more in flow. Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
So I am, how would you say that, in mastery of? Is that the way you would say it? Right.
Sounds like you're mastering your feelings about your body.
Yeah, about my body, right.
And regulating your image of yourself internally and externally.
Right. Okay, so then no one else can master that. I am healthy in my mindset and my mastery.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Wow, congratulations, and thank you so much for presenting
that.
That's really an impressive piece of work.
Oh, thank you.
Very. Anyone else want to comment or ask or say anything about Jen's presentation? Any questions or affirmations?
Hi, this is Carrie Penny. Jennifer, I just wanted to thank you for being so vulnerable. It's helpful.
Thank you. Yeah, it was a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks so much for sharing that. Very impressive. Anything else before we move into the material? Anything else anyone would like to discuss? Okay, well, unless somebody else wants to volunteer now for December 2nd for the roadmap presentation, I'll just assign ones that each of you will do in our remaining classes. We need to do one each class now so that everyone will have an opportunity. And this is just a superb beginning. So excellent. Okay. All right. We're going to talk today about mastering states of mind. And I want to elaborate about some of this and explain it. So if there's something that I don't get to that's on the outline, I'll dictate it and send it to you. But close your eyes and imagine that you're at an auction. And the room is filled with 75 sophisticated-looking people in business attire. The auctioneer walks in and holds a $100 bill before the group. He explains the auction scenario. Bids move in $5 increments. The highest bidder wins the bill. The second highest bidder pays the bid but gets nothing in return. And he reminds the group, this is real money. Within seconds, the bids pass $100. Some of the 75 people push the bidding up to $300. Two of the people get into a bidding war. One of them ends up paying $465 for the $100 bill. The other owes $460 and gets nothing. Now, how could reasonable people pay more for something that it's worth, something that has an obvious concrete worth, like a $100 bill? Actually, this scenario has already happened. It's happened more than 600 times. The auctioneer, Professor Max Bazerman. The setting, Harvard JFK School of Government. The participants, investment specialists and economic gurus. Some of the brightest financial experts consistently pay 3 to 4 times the worth of the $100 bill just because of the way their minds work. Now, this isn't a stock whose perceived value is determined only by the bid, because the stock market isn't really a market, it's an auction. And the stock is worth only what somebody's bidding. But this has tangible, specific value. Professor Bazerman commented, I've never seen bidding stop below $100 in any of the more than 600 times I've done it. And I've done keynotes where twice someone has come to me after the presentation when I've included this and said, I was in one of those audiences. That's exactly what happened. Neither one would admit how far they went, but neither one of them wrote a check. So what happened here? What mind matters and brain business secrets are hiding in the open? Well, here's some of what we know, some contributions from the mind. Loss aversion. I'm not going to be the second highest bidder, still pay, and get nothing. And studies show that losing $100 makes you twice as unhappy as gaining $100 makes you happy. So we have an aversion to loss, a fear of pain. Another, sunk cost fallacy. well, I've already bid $260. I'll just go $10 higher. We justify continuing because what we've already put into it. Think about some project you've done. You've already exceeded your budget, but you've got it two-thirds of the way finished, so you can't stop there. So you, the sunk cost fallacy is, well, I just finish it. And here the rationale here, I'll just go $10 higher. You segment it and say, well, it's just $10 when it's really $270. So that's another fallacy of thinking. We'll talk about that in a bit. So here's some contributions from the brain now. The prefrontal cortex says stop at $95. The limbic system says, well, I'm excited. I'm going to win. I can't stop now. Our states of mind are vulnerable to emotional contagion. In that auction room, brains were on a collective tilt. The herd mentality was running wild. But here's the conversation even without the contagion. Prefrontal cortex says, let's save for retirement. The limbic system says, let's have that second cognac and buy the 27-inch iMac. Money behavior and financial decisions are sometimes, rarely, actually about money. If money were about math, no one would have debt, or at least personal debt. And $100 would simply be $100 instead of another number based on another state of mind. Here's one more brief scenario about how tilt can be contagious. 433 people voted on a proposal. It failed. If only 12 of those 433 people had voted yes instead of no, the outcome would have been exactly the opposite. The result? In the next 5 hours, the stock market lost $1.2 trillion. Here's what one senior equity trader on Wall Street said. You just felt like the world was unraveling. People started to sell, and they sold hard. It didn't matter what you had, you sold. This collective tilt shows how states of mind are vulnerable to emotional contagion. This vote on the mortgage bailout in late 2008 crystallized an entire economic scenario of events. Chuck Prince, the then head of Citigroup, said, as long as the music is playing, you got to get up and dance. See how everybody falls into that contagion. Greed, emotional contagion, peer pressure, all trump logic. When you see friends making significant profits trading stocks or flipping real estate, the natural inclination is to want in on the action. As more join the movement, prices rise, and for a while, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. But then some event reverses the momentum, bursts the bubble, and turns optimism into panic. Herd mentality then pushes people to join the momentum, to either buy or flee the market and sell. Now, people aren't stupid. They're just not regulated. They make mistakes. They buy low. They sell high, either because they don't have a plan or they don't stick to it when emotion vaults beyond the fence of that plan. Even when they're finance or economic experts, they'll pay $350 for a $100 bill or over $6 for a stock they know is worth $3 twice in a row. They don't suddenly get smart the third round. They learn to regulate. Here's a simple example. Google announced its financial results for the fourth quarter of 2005 on January 31st, 2006. Revenues were up 97%. Net profits up 82%. Phenomenal growth. Wall Street analysts had predicted even better. Their prediction were actually one penny more per share for that quarter earnings than the actual outcome. When Google reported, the stock lost $22.3 billion in the next 5 minutes before trading was halted. And the only difference was the analysts were a penny off in the earnings. The intrinsic value of the company didn't change whatsoever. The great investment analyst Benjamin Graham was asked what it takes to be a successful investor. His response, people don't need extraordinary insight or intelligence. What they need most is the character to adopt simple rules and stick to them. Bazerman's auction is an example of creating a bubble. Bubbles are a market phenomenon in which value is inflated significantly beyond its basic worth. a collective tilt, a collective state of mind. Now, stop me at any time if you want to talk more about this or expand on it, because I believe this is the most important concept that we have in coaching, the most important success strategy that we can help our clients with. So let's talk a little bit about regulating states of mind. A state of mind is a mind-body state, like a specific software program that determines how we perceive and then how we process information and how we respond. So a state of mind is a particular set of emotions, memories, mental models, and behavior patterns. And we each have several different states of mind. A key element in coaching is helping a client become aware of different states of mind and perhaps even what particular state works best for what purpose. Now, here's an illustration of simple and concrete illustration of state of mind, a kind of sort of black and white illustration. If you take a rat and put it in a maze, it can get to the cheese again and again. Now, if before you teach the rat to get to the maze, you inject it with just a little bit of amphetamine, just a little bit of a stress-like simulation, you teach it to get to the cheese, and it can go again and again. Now, if you take away the amphetamine, the rat doesn't know how to get to the cheese. It can literally, in that maze, die of starvation, even though it has in a part of its brain the information about how to get to the cheese, but it can't access it. Re-inject the amphetamine, the rat immediately goes to the cheese. State-specific learning, state-dependent memory. Now, a model of state of mind and regulation of states is the infant-adult interaction. In any one moment, the infant is totally in a particular state, content, upset, hungry, in pain. The adult empathically resonates with this state in order to lend the function of regulation until the infant soothes. With time, as infants develop, they learn to moderate this all-or-nothing state of mind and ultimately to internally regulate. This attachment and borrowed regulation is gradually internalized. Ultimately, they self-regulate. This is the analog, the foundation of collaboration and contingency among adults and among mentor coaches with clients. We engage in collaborative conversations with our clients and help them to both understand and regulate states of mind. Coaching then needs to be both heart-based and brain-based for balanced learning and growth. And we now know that this collaborative communication and empathic connection creates new neural connections for the client. So here's a mentor coaching application. It's important for the mentor coach to enter into and hold the mind-body state of the client to understand the subjective experience as well as the story communicated by the client. Now, developmentally, the right brain communicates emotionally way before the verbal linguistics of the left brain mature. Most of the interactions in a relationship are outside conscious awareness in a right brain to right brain communication of emotional states of both coach and client. So the mentor coach must remain open to receiving communication from the client's right brain to become attuned to the state of mind of the client. This precedes synthesizing and planning. Once the mentor coach is tuned into the client, the coach can then receive and resonate with communication in all forms, not just verbal. They together can then explore experiences, possibilities, brainstorm, and plan. This resonance can also creatively transform the experience into new ideas, co-creations, beyond where either might go alone. So the mentor coach must allow this right brain engagement of taking in emotional communication to hold unexplained experiences, feelings, and ideas until a recognizable pattern emerges. This requires deep listening and attention simultaneously at multiple levels. It's a way of thinking and a way of experiencing combined. It's the art and science of mentoring. So, a few words about the neuroscience of decision and conflict. You see a car swerving into your lane headed directly for you. In a matter of seconds, your life could be over. As soon as you perceive the danger, you reflexively hit the brake pedal and horn and sharply turn the steering wheel. In a matter of a very few seconds, your physiology has changed. You're exhausted, short of breath, your heart is racing. Emotional chemicals triggered by an automatic alarm reaction instantly change your state of mind to one of survival. Every thought and feeling has a chemical consequence, not a cause, but a consequence. The chemicals of emotion alter mind and body. Personal experience determines what software program, in other words, what state of mind, to use to process the data, and then how to respond. When incoming data resembles a threat or danger, it instantly triggers an emotional and biochemical response within a fraction of a second. These chemicals of this emotional state hijack the logical, rational brain, which is a natural survival response. But emotion-based states where rational ones need to be or need to prevail may make you use information in an unhelpful way or perceive other than normal information. This automatic alarm system can cause mistaken perception and judgment. A hot stock tip, a business deal gone sour, a family tragedy, or just being alone at night and hearing noise outside, and you perceive a kind of danger that you wouldn't normally in a situation in the daytime or when you're with somebody. Any of these can create an alarm response in an emotional state of mind that's geared for survival rather than more balanced to use logic. Or, and consider this, if the mentor coach remains in a logical, intellectual frame of mind, a necessary empathic resonance to connect with a client's emotional experience may be missed. And this can occur if instead of resonating empathically and communicating that with a client who is upset or in a different state of mind than usual, and instead going directly into a strategy and a planning, we'll miss the most important aspect of creating common ground together. So there's a disharmony there that may not get addressed or created. Now, here's some additional examples of how, at times, logic can take a back seat in certain kinds of decision-making. Brain scans show that when people feel they're being treated unfairly, a portion of the midbrain, called the interior insula, lights up and overwhelms the logical considerations of the prefrontal cortex. This is the same kind of disgust that people have when they encounter a rotten apple. Making an example of people like Ken Lay and the prosecution of other executives for their crimes doesn't work and will not work. If it would be sufficient, Ponzi would have been the last needed to teach us this lesson. To make an example is an abstraction. That's not how the emotional brain works. That would be like moving into strategy and planning with a client who's upset instead of resonating with the upset and both of you coming to a common ground together. Think about it like a child who's just a young child who's skinned his knee and he's really upset, and you go to the child. That's not the time to institute a lesson about doing something dangerously or you shouldn't have crossed the street. The first response that's needed is to resonate with the upset of the child, not to go to the same level of the child or you're rendered useless, but to resonate midway, and then the child will join you midway, and then you can come back down together. Then you strike while the iron's cold to talk about things in a more logical way. So it's a two-step process always to get centered and then move to a place that will work better. To continue this example, the Ken Lay example, when something bad happens to people we envy, the result is that we may feel good. Neuroscientists at the University of Cambridge found that news of the downfall of the rich and famous activates the dorsal anterior cingulate cortex, the brain. Their humiliation activates this region of the brain that responds to conflict and social rejection. In fact, the studies show the more we envy somebody, the greater the pleasure at his or her downfall. This accounts for the much-watched footage of a high-powered CEO who earned tens of millions of dollars in bonus get humiliated in front of a congressional committee exposing indiscretion or doing the perp walk. And think about it. When Bernie Madoff got shoved on the sidewalk, be honest, how many times did you rewind? Actually, you probably didn't have to rewind because the CNN people did it a half dozen times each showing just to be sure. And, you know, another example. Shopping can change the way you feel. It can be state-changing. The anticipation of spending money is state-changing. And when people feel insecure, either emotionally or economically, they try to regulate their state of mind by doing something that will elevate their state of mind, whether that's, you know, a drug, an alcohol, shopping. For the most expensive shops on Madison Avenue, one of their best days in history was the day Lehman Brothers failed. When the going gets tough, brain scans also show that the nucleus accumbens, the pleasure center of the brain, one that's associated with a reward, lights up when people consider a purchase. Now, this is something very different than we thought for a long time. We thought that, you know, when somebody does something that's pleasurable, when they buy something, when they do something that boosts the reward system, they get a hit of dopamine, they feel good about it, that's the payoff. Well, that's not the way it happens. The anticipation of the pleasure or the act is what kicks off the dopamine. It's the anticipation of spending money or the purchase. When the person is hooked up to an fMRI, a video of the brain, and approach a slot machine or a blackjack table, before they ever sat down and touch the machine or touch the table, they've already had a spike in dopamine. So the pleasure center and the pain center compete with each other to determine whether you're going to buy something. The pain center is the payment, and the pleasure center is the anticipation. And remember, we talked about this is how when somebody uses credit cards, there's a segmentation of the pleasure of the purchase versus the pain of the repayment. So somebody can relegate it to the future. And this is why, one of the reasons why people purchase more with a credit card, on average 23% more than when they pay cash or check. The pain of payment is relegated to a theory, to the vague future. It's an abstraction that does not cause pain. An abstraction does not cause the pain center to fire. Now, let's talk about choice enhancement. And if there are any questions, please stop. Does this make sense so far? A resounding silence means a resounding yes.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
Thank you. I don't feel so lonely anymore. Thank you.
We're with you. Keep going.
Okay, great. So let's talk about choice enhancement for a moment. Some of these considerations may apply to emotions and choices that may be helpful to think about in working with clients. And I want to give you just an example of a couple of quotes from a recent client, an executive woman, as we go through this. Increased tension produces emotional regression. In other words, when there's greater stress, there's a tendency to move someone to an emotional pattern characteristic of a much earlier age. My client said, you know, I must be doing something wrong. All the things I know to do aren't working. And when I later asked her the age of this conversation, because she said some other things, she said, this is exactly the conversation I had with myself when I was an early teenager, because it felt like nothing I did would ever work, and that's the way I've been feeling in this stressful time. Two, increased emotion narrows perspective. And this is how this client put it. I'm so preoccupied with my portfolio losing value, it's hard to focus on my work. So when emotion prevails, focus becomes narrower and more restricted to the most recent events. It's called the recency effect, because there's more of an emotional charge. It occupies more of the foreground, and it's more recent because, you know, it has a greater emotional charge. So the escalated individual, this is the key for working with somebody. Somebody who's escalated in a stressful time will further escalate or further deepen that alarm pattern when you try to use reason and logic. So you have to meet them where they are and to resonate empathically before they can get to a more calm state and engage with you in a conversation. And again, trying to use reason and logic, which is very obvious, will make them dig in their toes and spiral into more extreme responses and hurl themselves away from logic. Really important to remember, I think. 3, when you're in a state of upset, the first order of business is to regulate feelings, not to figure out anything. It's not about content. It's about process. And remember this, and we're going to come back to it in just a moment. State always comes first, then strategy, and then story. And the most common mistake I see in coaching is that people try to move either into strategy to figure out what needs to be done because somebody has an obvious need and they're really upset. So when you're in a state of upset, first order of business to regulate feelings, to restore a cool state, to restore that balance by getting grounded and centered. 4, lump tasks according to states of mind required to do them. It takes energy to change state of mind, so by clustering similar tasks that require the same state of mind is a pretty efficient strategy. Going back and forth during the same time period between tasks that call for different states of mind can be both exhausting and inefficient. For example, creative writing and editing, two different parts of the brain, two different states of mind. It's useful not to go back and forth between the two, but schedule yourself for one or the other. And as part of that, learn the optimum state of mind for a particular task. And to know your biorhythm about what part of the day you're most likely to be able to enter that state of mind, that zone, and do that most effective work. And then protect your time for an endeavor for a particular state of mind. So basically, then, tension regulation and de-escalation tools are essential to foster listening and communication and collaboration with somebody. So our use of empathic listening and communication of understanding is a central tool to help someone regulate emotion and restore reason. I'll give you an example of a case of applying this. And I'm going to use the neural conditioning chart that I'd sent to you as an attachment earlier. So if you have that, you might look at it, because I use that and further refine that in working with him. I'll call my client Jim. Jim was the COO of a large healthcare company in a major U.S. city when we first started working together. As a result of our work together, just really about 2 or 3 months, he decided to toss his hat in the ring for a CEO position. He had some great offers and crafted a terrific compensation package. Fairly soon, Jim and another company's CEO, and I'm going to call him Tom, were negotiating a joint venture. This was something that the companies already had going when Jim came aboard. And Jim said, look, I'm more myself now than I've ever been. I'm way beyond what I had imagined. But this one, I just can't get my arms around. When Tom gets on his soapbox and explains simple things to me, like he would to a novice, I overreact. I want to tell him off. It's like a put-down. And I said, I understand how when you take it personally, it bruises your pride. What ideally would you like to do? He said, well, I have to think and not react. But I get sucked in even when I know what not to do. He just sets me off the way he talks down to me, like he knows it all. It's like I can't not respond. I need a strategy. So he recognized that this reactive mode made him depart a state of mind where he could reason and negotiate strategically. And I asked, what can you still do and be yourself and be effective in those instances when you feel personally insulted. He said, I have to think and not react. I have to let him finish his points and get the emotion out of it. He was saying, in effect, that he needed to regulate his state of mind and manage his emotions to be effective. So how to do that in this situation? So I had him use the neuroconditioning chart, and I suggested that he schedule a brainstorming session with himself to address the first two columns. The emotional triggers are cues that he was aware of. Everything about Tom, what he said, the interactions, anybody else that was involved, that he write down all of the triggers and then write down what his usual response was to each of the triggers. And the triggers were different. Sometimes the response would be different. And I emphasized about how important it was for him to stay present during this time, to not enter that state and not kind of self-induce a trigger, but to observe, to reflect on, a reflective functioning, a mentalization to look at how his mind was working. Then at a different time, I suggested he schedule another, I think I said 30-minute brainstorming appointment with himself to look at developing a new story, to look at how, for each of these triggers and responses, he would plan to get grounded and centered. And we're going to talk about developing a mantra in just a minute. And then to really focus on what he wanted his ideal response or behavior to be, because this was what he was going to have to work at getting to initially. And the writing down of the trigger and the usual response was to cue his radar to be really aware, actively aware early on of this process, so that instead of, you know, getting into it and then recognizing it 30 or 40 minutes or at the end of the meeting later, he could immediately recognize it and have a plan to get centered and to respond with an ideal response. So he developed this chart. And as we talked about it and talked about applying it, one of the things I emphasized was for him to not take it personally, whatever Tom or anyone else said. The principle, everybody's always making self-statements. So I encouraged him to hear it as though Tom were showing Jim exactly what it was like to be Tom. So Jim recognized he was taking personally the behavior he'd seen Tom engage in. And when he understood it that way, he said, well, he probably feels threatened or insecure at times when he gets on his soapbox and lectures. So he developed a mastery and the ability to have insight and observation about his response and the response of Tom. So by recognizing these early warning signs of the emotional triggers and responses, he could develop a different response. Now, I emphasized to him that in the beginning, going to have to actively use this chart and refer to it until he does it enough that it will become automatic, and these cues or triggers, instead of cueing this reactive response, will cue an ideal behavior. And what I also suggested in the beginning was that Jim write down what he was going to do. He'd take notes while Tom was talking. It sort of kept him from verbally reacting. And he could plan what he wanted to say, because I knew this was all new for him. So he planned his strategy of response, could review it and make it objective and reasoned. So when Jim stayed in the logical part of his brain, he did great. His regulation of state of mind allowed him to sustain effectiveness rather than be emotionally derailed. And much later, as we were ending our work, he said, you know, I really reflect back on understanding Tom. I understand him and me and people like him way better. I have an easier time with encounters with guys like him. So let's talk about a practical application, how to do this, how to set this up, how to work through those third and fourth columns. The most important thing we can do to achieve success, I believe, is to manage our emotions and regulate our states of mind. What do these people have in common? John Belushi, Marilyn Monroe, Elvis Presley, Janis Joplin, F. Scott Fitzgerald. They never learned the critical success strategy of managing their states of mind. Using drugs, alcohol, or some other addictive substance or process to regulate a state of mind leads to significant compromise. And an addiction can be described as when a behavior becomes the central organizing factor of your life. Now, there are two primary ways to regulate your state of mind: physiology, how you use your body, and focus, what and how you focus on. So here are a couple of examples of the use of physiology and focus. Physiology can simply be a deep breathing exercise to breathe in relaxation and breathe out tension. And the focus, what and how you focus on it. Remember, your power is what you focus on. And what you focus on can be an affirming statement that empowers you. Now, think about how we focus ordinarily. We're always asking ourselves questions that determine our focus. The question we ask determines our focus. Same for someone else, by the way, which is a very powerful principle of influence. The questions we ask ourselves determine what we focus on. Two questions we're always asking: what does this mean? What should I do? If you have an habitual feeling you don't like, it can come from an habitual focus and habitual question. Why does this always happen to me? The presupposition is that you're in a past position and ineffective. Why am I overweight? The focus is on overweight. So change the question. Ask a better question. You're always asking questions from the moment you wake up, although you may not be aware of it. If you immediately began asking, what could go wrong today? You've already begun scenarios that establish state of mind. So ask a better question. What will I create today that will be more powerful than I ever dreamed of and have fun doing? Your brain follows your focus, whether that's positive or negative. So ask habitual questions that empower you. So here's an exercise, and I've recommended this exercise to a couple of clients, and I came up with it when I was a guest speaker at a Vistage group, the CEO group, because in that group, two of the members had, it's a group of like CEOs or business owners, two of the people had really, really devastating things happen at their company. Like one was somebody had been killed, but just some things that were preoccupying them, and the CEOs or the owners were worried, and they were preoccupied all day, and it was really affecting them, it was creating stress. And I talked about this principle and asked that each of the people in the group try this exercise. Before they go to bed, write down three questions that are empowering questions, questions that will put them in a peak state or really a peak performance state, and put them by their bedside. And the first thing they do when they turn on their lamp in the morning, before they're even fully awake, to answer those questions. Because we're always answering questions, usually before we're even awake and before we're consciously aware of it. Like, you know, they were recognizing, they were thinking, oh, God, what can go wrong today? Or, you know, is this going to have more consequences? Is this going to have legal consequences? You know, all the negative things that would get them in a negative loop, in a spiral. When each of the people took these three questions that they would do, and they would change the question day by day at times, they recognized that it put them in a peak state, in a positive state, that lasted several hours into the day and determined the rest of the day because it built on that state instead of getting into a negative loop. So let's look now at that third column, the mantras. When Southern Utah University's new basketball coach, Robert Reed, arrived, his team ranked 217th in free throw percentage out of 217 in their division nationwide. During practice, Reed had his players develop a mantra before each free shot. It would be a cue, and it was like dribbling the basketball a couple of times at the line, a 3 or 4 word phrase coupled with a deep breath for relaxation, breathing in relaxation, breathing out tension. He gave the example of the phrase relaxed and smooth when they would step up to the free throw line, but he emphasized that each player determined his own mantra. So they had a cue, a focus, and a physiology. Now, additionally, he simulated game conditions by abruptly stopping a player in practice and asking him to shoot 2 free throws. So this is like a game situation, because you don't get to line up and shoot 30 free throws in a game and get to count the best one. You suddenly stop. You're usually on tilt because somebody's just fouled you, and you're in a pressure situation. You go to the line. You either have a home crowd or an away crowd, and you get all kinds of stimulation. So if the player made the shot, he got to take a breather. If he missed, he had to sprint the court. In 2 years, the team was ranked #1 in their division nationwide. So mantras can be used in various situations to regulate states of mind, especially for emotional triggers that can instantly change a state of mind. And some of my clients are pro athletes and actors who've used it to get grounded and centered for their performance. And both kinds of performance professionals are very conscious of managing states. They have to, if you see somebody like a tennis player, I've worked with some pros and some Olympic tennis players. If you see a tennis player bounce a ball twice before serving, she probably is doing some kind of cue for a mantra that may include a focus, that may include a deep breath, that will get her centered and totally in the flow. So both mantras can both calm as well as keep you from overthinking in a high-pressure situation. A mantra that I use, since you ask for a keynote, is I put, since I usually carry a basketball, is to put my index finger and my thumb together on both hands, and I form 2 little circles, and then put them together so it's like an infinity sign. And at the time I'm saying a phrase, relaxed and powerful, and I breathe 1 deep breath in for relaxation, 1 deep breath out for any tension, and in about 3 or 4 seconds, I'm good to go. And I do the same thing before I receive a call from a client, so that I'm totally immersed in the process. Now, let me give you an example of an application here in a case. We're close on time. Let me just do the case real quick, and then we'll have some discussion, and I'll see if there's anything that we didn't talk about. This was a CPA who would function brilliantly when he focused, came immersed on a specific task, but was challenged because when there were external distractions, he got derailed and had trouble moving from task to task, to project through the day in a seamless continuity because he had ADD. And he initially consulted me because he wanted to move his CPA firm from a local to a regional and then a national presence, develop a partnership structure and that sort of thing. But we saw the first thing he needed to do was really to look at self-regulation. So for him, self-regulation involved establishing an entire weekly and then daily schedule so that he had a map so he could really look at where he was. And I also had him keep a daily hourly schedule. I suggested that he create a schedule for the week, so he had a map for the week. And then he worked a lot. He would do his sustained work, his uninterrupted work, at a computer, an iMac. So I worked with one of those, so I know exactly what it looks like. I had him put his daily schedule on the left, hour by hour, and then on the right, a post-it note of what he was to do that hour. So he would immediately get oriented by looking at where he was. He could stay focused. And then at the end of that hour, he'd replace that with a more detailed bullet of what he was going to be doing this hour. So this helped him sustain focus. And then additionally, what I suggested that he do is schedule blocks of uninterrupted time to sustain a state of mind, to preclude interruptions by, at the time he needed to really stay focused and immersed in work, to schedule that so that his secretary had no interruptions, no calls, would let no one back to him. So he didn't have to turn off his telephone ringer. He just instructed his secretary, his assistant, to do that. Additionally, to recognize the time of day to do certain tasks, such as for him, creative time early in the morning, and to protect those times. And also to cluster the activities that required for him the same state of mind. So he would do errands all together at the same state. So this helped him regulate things for himself that created a kind of structure that he managed his state of mind and the regulation in a self-imposed way, rather than having somebody determine that by responding to a call or responding to somebody coming by or responding to a curbside consult. He was actively in charge of his day and structured it, and it became immensely more productive. So he managed not only his own ADD and found that a significant advantage when he created the structure for it, because he could get even more immersed, and was able to very successfully move to the partnership structure and to expand. Now, any thoughts or questions? We don't have as much time as I'd hope, but any thoughts or questions or clarifications about what we've talked about? Does this make sense to you in terms of working with clients?
Oh, Dave, this is Lalia. Sorry, I have to actually go, but I just wanted to tell you I want to know more about this whole thing about asking the question. I thought that was brilliant, and it was, for me, just a real aha moment. I mean, I know, of course, about asking questions, but the way...
Are you talking about recommending that a client write down questions?
Yes, that was just so incredible.
I recommend that they do it, and I leave it up to them to do it.
Maybe when I do my story next week.
Okay.
Next week.
All right, great. Because I leave it up to the client to write the questions. I may give an example, as I gave here, questions that are empowering and put you in a peak state that set the day in motion in a very positive way. So I give guidelines, but I don't ghostwrite it for them, and I may give an example if they ask, but that's it. So... That may be something that would be useful. And I do recommend that exercise for you, each of you, just to see if it works. Okay? Thank you for that. Other thoughts or questions, clarifications? Does this make sense to you? Anything at all? Yes, please.
Seems pretty straightforward to me.
Okay. Anything you'd like me to expand on anymore that I didn't really take time to do?
I would like, just curious, at some point, just one more time on mantras, because... seems like there's a lot of hype around that, but like really making them be effective and concise, there's got to be an art to that.
Well, I think the art is to make it personal for you and to make a cue one that you would find useful for you. I do mine because I can do it under the table or in my lap and nobody sees it to do my little finger, but it's just a cue to remind me to do that. And then, to have a phrase that really focuses you. There's been some I mentioned in the mentor group today, some very recent research from Mass General about how a focus on particular positive words can enhance the gene's expression that reduce stress. And the study peace was used. So peace is an interesting one to think about at night to go to sleep. Ones that put you in a peak state for the particular function is very useful, because I don't want to get all peaceful before I do a keynote. I want to get in a peak performance state. So relaxed and powerful is going to put me there in the best place, or to work with a client, because I'm excited about mixing it up with somebody and ready to get started and ready for somebody to call me and excited when they call. So I'm ready to go, but I'm centered, but I'm ready to go. And then the relaxation, the physiology, you know, long term it can be something like exercise, and exercise every day can be a powerful way of regulating physiology, because your whole nervous system gets in shape. But to do it immediately, breathing in tension and breathing out breathing in relaxation and breathing out any tension. And there have been studies, especially from Buddhism, that have shown that meditation on a regular basis, a 10-minute time of meditation on a daily basis, can not only enhance relaxation, lower blood pressure, but it can also boost immune response. So there are significant benefits for that. So the mantra is just the three parts that are really individually determined, that would be determined by what works best for you. And a mantra for, say, a keynote may not be the mantra for, I have a different mantra when I go to bed, when I go to sleep. So, you know, it's just a way of really having a positive focus and a relaxation that is, you know, mind, body, spirit. Does that make sense to you, or does that still leave some questions?
Yeah, that's helpful. I'm going to experiment with it. It's helpful.
Okay, great. Well, we're out of time, and Jen, thanks again for an outstanding presentation and piece of work, and for sharing it with us. That's terrific. You set an incredible standard. So we will pick up.
You're welcome.
We will not meet next week. Remember, I'm going to be doing a retreat next week, so we're going to pick up exactly 2 weeks from today. So I'll see you in 2 weeks. So thanks very, very much.
Okay, bye, Dave. Thank you.
See you now. Absolutely.